Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Welcome to Orange Ribbon on Joy 94.9, tonight with just me, Alan Smales. On tonight's program, I chat with a Hong Kong Chinese guy who is the youngest of a large family and who became sexually active at a quite young age. He discusses his family, his early sexual awakening, and his HIV-positive diagnosis at the age of 18. He's now 39 years of age and tells me about his initial reaction and how his attitude to life changed over the ensuing 21 years living with HIV. So once again, we've got another fascinating discussion coming up tonight here on Orange Ribbon. So please stay with me for the next hour here on Joy 94.9. Welcome to Orange Ribbon, tonight with just me, Alan Smales. That's Eason Chan from his Solidays and album. And during tonight's program, because it's primarily Hong Kong-based, I'm playing music from some albums that I picked up while I was in Hong Kong over the last month. Before we kick the program off, a giveaway. We get this off right at the beginning of the program. We have two double passes. That's two double passes to give away to the Human Rights Arts and Film Festival to Jerusalem is Proud to Present. It's on Friday, the 21st of November, which means it's in 2 days' time at 6:30 p.m. at Kino Cinemas here in Collins Street. So that means you would need to be able to come in and pick up the tickets here at Joy. So that's two double passes. First two callers in, 96992949, and you're able to pick up those tickets. I've just returned from another few weeks in Hong Kong, and one of my very good friends up there is a Chinese local whose name is Mark. Now, I've been discussing with Mark the potential for recording this interview with him over several recent visits to Hong Kong. But a couple of weeks ago, I finally convinced him to allow me to record the interview that you'll be hearing here on Orange Ribbon tonight. Mark's story is very interesting and gutsy because only once before on this program, Orange Ribbon, have I been able to interview an Asian guy who was HIV positive and who had been prepared to discuss his life around living with HIV. And so with sincere thanks to Mark, he agreed to talk about his life in Hong Kong, his diagnosis as being HIV positive at the age of just 18 years, living with HIV in Hong Kong both in the mid-1980s and in the present day, and the fact that he's still here with us and living a healthy life some 21 years later. Mark comes from a large and somewhat unusual family, so I started out by asking him to tell me a little about his family structure.
Well, basically, you know, my family is a very traditional family, you know, and my mother had an arranged marriage, you know, early in China. So she had five children from the first husband, and then she moved to Hong Kong, you know, after the divorce, and brought two children from the first husband and remarried to my father, and have another five children. So there are a total of 10, and I'm the 10th.
What was the reason for your mum deciding to come to Hong Kong?
I think for a better living, for sure.
So was it seen, we're talking, what, some 40-odd years or so ago, from the China perspective, Hong Kong was seen as a better life?
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned that you're the youngest in 10, with five half-siblings, if you like. What's the age difference? You're the youngest. What's the age difference between you and the eldest?
There are 24 years between my eldest brother and me. And in between, you know, there are actually, the total is six sons and four daughters in the family.
Now, with such a large family, does the family get together at all, or is it fairly segregated, and say your half-brothers and sisters, do you have anything to do with them?
Well, basically, most of the family, including their kids and their grandkids, you know, living in Hong Kong, but rarely we have a total family reunion. Because, you know, it's just too many people.
How many nephews and nieces and whatever would you have?
Well, for the third generation, that is, you know, my mom, for my mom, I would say, she has 10 children, approximately about, you know, 16 or 17 grandchildren, and probably 5 or 6, you know, great-grandchildren. I lose count of them, you know, just, you know, some of them I just don't see that often at all.
Now, with such a large family and with such a large range in age between yourself being the youngest and the eldest, I think you told me your mum is still alive. She must be getting very old now.
Yeah, I mean, she's, according to the ID card, she's 84. In reality, we have no idea. Probably 86 or something.
So, yeah, when you say in reality, is that saying either she doesn't let on, or is it the fact that decent records were never kept in China?
Yeah, it's like, I think that, you know, by the time she came to Hong Kong, you know, and get her ID card, you know, basically they can't verify, actually. You know, so there will be a possibly, you know, it's only approximate, you know, date or year that, you know, she could remember.
And when she first moved to Hong Kong, what sort of, was she working, or, and if so, what sort of work was she doing?
Well, she's basically a housewife, and my father is actually a hawker selling fruits, and she was basically helping, you know, my father at the store.
What about you? Would it have been like most families where the children would have had a part in the business as well, as helping out as a child? Did you have anything to do with that?
Well, because my father actually passed away when I was 2. That was, you know, 36 years ago. And after that, basically, you know, my mother, you know, couldn't manage to run the store, you know, with so many, you know, young kids, you know, in the family. So basically some of my older brothers and sister, you know, start working early, you know, actually left school early, would say, like, high school time, to kind of, like, support the family. So, basically, nobody is, you know, in the fruit business now.
Now, you mentioned earlier that your mum brought 2 of your half-brothers and sisters, or whatever they were, to Hong Kong. What happened to the other 3? There would have been 5 from that marriage. What's happened to the other 3? Why did they not come to Hong Kong?
Well, they are actually still in Hong Kong. They actually, you know, moved to Hong Kong afterwards, you know. And, I mean, we still see each other some, you know, from time to time. In a way, as I said, you know, because the family is so big, and some of my brothers and sisters I only see once a year or once 2 years, you know. So I would never say that we're close at all, you know.
In Western culture, you'd be going through major annual events such as Christmas, birthdays, and all that sort of thing. And as an uncle, as I am, for example, you sort of expected to buy birthday presents and Christmas presents. It'd be a little bit awkward for you. You'd have so many. I guess it wouldn't be a habit in your family.
That's something lucky, I would say. Because in my family, you know, we hardly celebrate, you know, birthday. That's a strange, you know, habit, you know, in my family. Christmas is not a Chinese family thing, you know, so, you know, I usually spend my Christmas overseas.
What about Chinese New Year, though?
Yes, we do. You know, we do, you know, get together. You know, in a way, I would say probably 1/3 of the family get together. And others, you know, come to see my mom, you know, at different time, you know. So we might bump into each other in a couple of occasions, you know.
Is any of the family in China now, or is basically the whole family in Hong Kong now?
The whole family is in Hong Kong, yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is Alan Smales. I'm in Hong Kong, and my guest tonight is Mark.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Alan Smales in Hong Kong, and my guest in this program is Mark. Now, the gay boy in you, I think you told me off air you knew from very young age that you were gay. Why, how did you know that?
I don't know, you know, it's somehow I get my first erection, you know, because I was aroused, you know, looking at guys, that's, you know, obvious.
So I suppose you went through the male underwear catalogue thing and all that sort of thing like the rest of us did.
Yeah, we all do.
Now, what about, well, we don't want to go into the specifics of your sexual experiences, but at what age were you starting to have sex?
Around 11, 12.
Oh, my God.
I would say that, you know, basically, you know, when I can have sex, you know, I have sex. I had it already.
Now, was it easy to find partners at that age? I mean, at 12, I mean, was it with other boys or with older people?
Well, basically older people, because I would say that partly because of the family issue, I was more attracted to, you know, more mature guys. And in a way, you know, physically, I get more attracted by, you know, more stocky and hairy guys, which means that, or facial hair, I would say, which means that, you know, in general, Asians are not that hairy. So I tend to get attracted by Westerners.
So did you, at what age would you have had your first boyfriend, or what you would classify as a semi-regular partner?
Probably about, I think, 12, 13.
My goodness.
Not, I wouldn't say that it's a boyfriend. It's more like a regular guy, you know, that I see, you know, often, I would say, you know.
So, did you see it as slightly unusual that you were doing this when presumably your peers at the time were more interested in girls? And what did you think of them, and what did they think of you if they knew what was going on about you?
Well, of course, at that time, you know, I didn't come out, you know, and, you know, I didn't particularly pretend I'm straight. I just try to avoid that issue in a way at that time. Basically, I hide myself, you know, on that part, you know, from the regular, you know, context, and I think it's okay, you know, it's not a problem.
Did you at any stage go through the girlfriend bit or not at all?
No, never. Not at all, never.
Okay, you had a sort of a semi-regular friend, if you like, from whatever it was, 13 or 14. Did you get to a point where you felt that you had a more of a boyfriend, if you like, than just a regular buddy?
Well, actually, I would say until very, very late, you know, talking about 17, 18, you know, I started having a feeling, you know, on the love side, you know. But before that, I would say from, you know, like 11, 12 to 17, 18, you know, basically it's more on the sexual side.
When you did, say, at 17 or 18, did it feel any different, the fact that you felt some sort of affection for somebody, or was it still just sex, 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 if you like?
Well, I think that's the time that I met someone, and he's not particularly, you know, sexual in a way, or sexually active. So, you know, what he, you know, I got kind of like attached in a way, is more emotional side. That's one thing that is, you know, actually changed the mentality a little bit.
What about the attitudes in general in Hong Kong at this stage? Now, we're, what, talking about the early 80s, I guess. Now, homosexuality was decriminalised in Hong Kong, I think, in the early 90s, around about 91. Mm. Did you have any concern during the early, mid-80s that you might get caught out, or there might be any trouble that you could get yourself into?
I think at that time I was probably too naive to worry about that. And I would say that some of the time that I thought that it might be, you know, it might be get caught or whatever, but, you know, I think the sex drive, you know, in the body, you know, push us, you know, a little bit
further.
What about the fact that you said that you were seeing older guys? Did you see that as an issue? Because presumably they were a fair bit older, like in their 20s or 30s or maybe 40s, I don't know. Did you see that as a potential additional risk to yourself?
Well, at that time, basically, I would say most of the regulars I see are, I would say, over 45. Because in a way, they just give me a lot of, security feeling, emotionally, I would say, And, I had great time, with them.
What about the general attitudes in Hong Kong at that stage? Had somebody found out, like your parents or whatever, presumably there would have been a pretty major to-do if somebody found out.
At that time, in general, yes, it could be some serious family problem, if the family find out that the boy is actually gay. That's why at that time you hardly, know anybody, like my school friends, that, openly admit that, they are gay, even, amongst the schoolmates, that's the, the general, atmosphere, I would say, in the society.
Just following on that theme just for a moment, have you discovered in later years guys that you either went to school with or you knew from those days that you've subsequently found out were gay but obviously hid it through your younger days?
Many. Because I was at a boys' school, actually. And, I mean, some of them, of course, they are a bit more obvious, because in general, I think, people probably see Asian gay guys are more feminine looking in a way. They, go to the toilet, they spend like, 15 minutes looking at the mirror and, tidying up their hairs and that sort of thing. But there are some more masculine, schoolmates, actually. I was not sure at school time, and only very late after school, that we basically openly discussed this,
Changing tack ever so slightly, one of the things I meant to ask you about a little earlier is more to do with general issues. Your English is particularly good, and I think I remember you telling me once you even think in English. How did your English capabilities come about?
That was actually a major change in mentality when I considered that I start thinking in English, which helps, the ability to speak English, is the time around O-level time, when I met this guy from America who is actually a lecturer of the polytechnics, which is a major flip, of my English spoken English ability.
So you still think in English, to this day, you still think in English?
Yeah.
This is Alan Smales, I'm in Hong Kong, and I'm speaking with my guest in this program, Mark.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is Alan Smales in Hong Kong, and my guest in this program is Mark. Now, before the break, you just happened to mention that I think you were around about 17 or 18 years of age, and you started having an affair with an American guy. That led to something that's affected the rest of your life, that is, that you discovered that you were HIV positive. How did that come about? Why and how did you... I'm turning in terms of the diagnosis. Why and what prompted you to get tested?
Well, basically, I met that guy and about, 1 year, just over a year and a half time, he was diagnosed, to be positive. So he came to me and mentioned that to me and asked, I should go for a test, because at that time I basically haven't had a test before. That was talking about, 1987. And so I went for the test, and it was it came out with the positive results.
What was your reaction upon that initial diagnosis? I mean, given that we're talking about the mid-80s when things weren't quite so positive, playing words there, as they are today in terms of those living with HIV, how did you feel at the time?
Well, I would say very peaceful in a way. You know, I was not very shocked or, you know, scared or in a way that is like panic. Partly because I probably didn't know too much about the problem and didn't see that much of the impact on, you know, how I think about my life or the future of my life. This would, you know, possibly cause, you know. So at that moment, I would say it was calm.
But given that at that stage, I guess most people held the view that it was basically a death sentence at that stage, that was the general attitude of a lot of people. Did you find that you, even if subconsciously, changed your attitude to life such that let's get all you can out of life while you can?
Yes, you know, when after I was diagnosed and I got to know a little bit more, yes, it's true. It's basically at that time it's a death sentence, you know. It's just a matter how long, you know, you can survive. So that's one thing that changed my mentality of continuing the education. Because that was the time that when I got my O-levels completed and I continued two more years to A-levels. But even I got a chance after A-levels to get to a college, basically I made a decision not to, because I was kind of like expecting, you know, it's probably only a few years to go, you know. So it's no point wasting, you know, a few years, you know, at college, and, you know, and then it might, you know, get worse.
How did you meet other guys, if any, or did you know any other positive guys? I mean, obviously you knew through this guy who you say probably transferred HIV to you, but did you know other positive guys in those days, and how hard was it being HIV positive in those days?
Actually, at that time, I didn't know too many people who's positive, or there are people I know that either they didn't have a test, or they say they don't, they are not positive, you know. So it's hard to say that those people, are they really negative, or they just ignore the fact that, you know, or they don't want to know they are positive or not, you know.
But do you think that attitude has really changed much in the meantime? I mean, even today, there's a lot of guys really don't want to know their status.
Well, for me, you know, from the current time looking at that, I would say it's not a good attitude not to have a test. And, you know, of course, you know, I know that it's psychological. A lot of people are afraid to know because they are afraid that they, whether they can handle, you know, that bad news or not, you know. But I think at that time, a lot of people basically just ignore the fact, you know, that it exists.
Was it a lonely time for you in those days, given that you were sort of living with that and probably couldn't discuss it with anybody? I mean, you're openly discussing it with me now, but admittedly it's 20-odd years later. But at that stage, was it a lonely time?
Well, I would say it's kind of lucky, because after I was diagnosed to be positive in 87, basically, 2 years later, I met my first boyfriend. Of course, you know, we had, you know, discussed this issue, and he had moved to Hong Kong. You know, despite the fact that, you know, he's negative and I'm positive, and we lived together since 1989 for 5 years together. So that is a major, I would say, a lucky part of me compared to a lot of other people, because it was not disclosed to my family even until now, and only selective friends, you know, I talk about this, you know, probably about 10 years ago, you know, so that means that, you know, about 10-11 years since I was diagnosed, you know, I've never discussed this except to my partner.
This is Alan Smales. I'm in Hong Kong speaking with Mark.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Alan Smales in Hong Kong. My guest is Mark, and we're talking about HIV, and Mark is living with HIV. As time has passed, that is, what, 21 years since you were diagnosed, we were talking earlier about your approach to life then, given that it was basically a life sentence in most people's, a death sentence in most people's eyes in those days. Things have changed for you in that you're still here 21 years later. As a result of that, how has your attitude to life changed?
Well, basically now I would say that I just look at life just like usual people. You know, because after, I would say probably after the cocktail treatment came up, and basically I see my health was not actually endangered in a way. I'm much healthier than other people, and it doesn't really affect a lot, you know, my daily life or my work or, you know, you know, my thinking about, you know, how I live my life, you know. So
now you mentioned medication. I presume it was AZT in those days. But when did you? How long into your diagnosis did you start on medication? And how did it affect you at that stage?
If I didn't remember wrongly, that's my first, you know, treatment. You know, with medication is probably started early 90s, you know, probably about, you know, 4 years, 4 or 5 years after the our diagnosis. And yes, AZT is the, you know, the first one. And then later on try, you know, a couple different ones. And then, you know, the cocktail treatment, which actually change a lot, because, you know, it's a lot of pills to take, but, you know, it's it had a much more significant result on the health issue.
What about your body's reaction to it and the changes that you've had over the years in terms of the changes to your medication regime? How has your body reacted?
Well, of course, you know, they are all having different side effects, you know, like you know sometimes diarrhea, and, you know, maybe sleeping problems, and, you know, other things, you know. But in general, it, you just need to get used to each, you know, combinations.
How does taking medication and the regime involved in that, how does it affect your day-to-day work and schedule? That is, you've got to take pills at certain times, and if you're going out and on all that sort of thing, how has it impacted how you organize your life day-to-day?
Well, luckily my combination is not that complicated, I would say. You know, in a way, the last, you know, two treatments, you know, one is like every 8 hours, so which means that, you know, it's only one is affecting my work life, which is about mid-afternoon. But the last, you know, combination was even better. It was like every 12 hours, so it's like a morning thing, you know, before I went to work, and, you know, the evening, you know, before I, you know, went to bed. And basically the current one, you know, which I just changed about a month and a half ago, 1.5 months ago, which is you know, basically the same 12 hours, you know, interval. But this one is much better than the last one, because compared to the last one, it was 17 pills a day, and now it's 9 pills a day. So it's a big, you know, major, you know, improvement, I would say.
Now, earlier we discussed how many positive guys you knew in your early days. Presumably, as time has gone by, your circle of friends, not necessarily intentionally, would have migrated to being involved with a number of more positive guys. Is that a fair comment?
Well, I think these days people are not so afraid to be known as positive, which means that some of the people that I knew before, either they were later got you know, infected, or they later on they just, you know, find out because they had the first test. But in a way, I would say that it's more open mind to, you know, talk about this issue. And yes, somehow it was a little bit of easier for us, you know, to talk to people who's positive too, because, you know, we have, you know, share some of the, you know, I would say difficulties or experience and things like that.
Here in Hong Kong, let's tackle this another way. In Australia, we have a number of gay medical clinics, general practitioners who oftentimes are gay doctors or lesbian doctors, who tend to, in a lot of cases, specialise in HIV treatments and so on. That wouldn't necessarily be the case, I presume, here in Hong Kong, or at least you wouldn't have openly gay doctors practising, perhaps. How, I guess where I'm leading to is this, is how do you deal, or how did you find dealing with the medical profession here in Hong Kong with Chinese doctors, presumably straight Chinese doctors?
Well, the lucky thing is, you know, Hong Kong government has this special unit for the HIV, you know, patients, you know, who, you know, where they have doctors, more likely they are straight, you know. But they are, you know, quite professional in a way. Basically, they don't have bias, you know, on either you are drug addict or, you know, you are, you know, homosexuals or something, you know, that you get infected, you know, from different channels. So in a way, I feel very comfortable, or it can be, you know, openly discuss, you know, all sorts of things. Of course, you know, if they are gay, you know, which might be easier, especially when we want to discuss a little bit, you know, along the sexual, you know, activities, because, you know, talking to a straight guy, you know, about gay sex, you know, it's kind of weird.
What's the general attitude of the broader community in Hong Kong to HIV guys? Now, homosexuality, as we said earlier, was decriminalised around about 91, I think. HIV is obviously a totally different kettle fish altogether in terms of public attitude. Do you think there's been any change from the general public's attitude point of view to HIV?
Well, I think for non-gay general public, HIV is still a very sensitive issue. You know, in a way, they do, in a way, have a little bit of discriminations, you know, on people who are, you know, positive. But for the gay community, you know, I would say that the last 10 years has, you know, improved a lot, you know, looking at, you know, positive people now.
Now, you've opted, I think, not to be involved in positive support groups. Any particular reason for that?
Well, major reason is, as I said earlier, about the, you know, how general, you know, public looking at the post issue. You know, if you in Hong Kong in general, if you are in the kind of like opened support group, you know, that you might have to, you know, concern, you know, whether you might, your strict boss might have discrimination on that, you know, knowing that you are actually a poor person and, you know, you are homosexual, it might somehow, you know, subconsciously affect your work career, which legally they can't do that, but, you know, human being is human being, you know, there's something that, you know, lie underneath that they can be, you know, their decisions can be, you know, affected because of this, you know, impression.
And finally, and you sort of touched on it there, we don't want to go into your work situation, but in general, your outlook in terms of work for you, HIV is not affecting your work at all. You seem to, you're happy with the type of work that you do. You can always get more work if you want, or presumably change jobs. You don't see that as being any barrier at all these days.
Well, basically, in my work life, you know, the HIV issue has not come to an issue at all. I would say that partly because of my attitude of, getting improvements, you know, in my ability, you know, to, you know, in work aspects, you know. But for some extent, for other people, I would say that it could be a major issue.
Okay, time against us, so we might wind it up there. So I've been speaking to Mark in Hong Kong, who's been prepared to talk to us about being gay, being HIV positive, and living in Hong Kong. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.